Hi, and welcome to the Bad Taste Book Club, where we talk about the books that are never going to make it into the literary canon. I'm Leah.
I'm Brie.
And today we're talking about Solace, which is by Gail Carriger.
We hope we're pronouncing that right.
If we're not, we're sorry. Okay, well, let's get down to it. I'm going to start you off with my favourite opening of any of these books, actually, I think. For Miss Alexia was born without a soul, which is any decent vampire of good blooding knew, made her a lady to avoid most assiduously. How can you not love that? That is a great way to introduce your character.
I love the fact that this book throws us immediately into the world. There's none of this mucking around with giving us a point of view character who's new to it or any of that. It's just smack bang straight in, and I think that's like, it does so much for the pacing of the book. Such a fun way to start a novel.
And given that this is her first outing, it's actually a very well-written first novel. I adore the writing. I adore most of the characters.
Yeah, the turn of phrase in this is really good. This was originally pitched to me by a friend who worked in a bookshop, and one of the ways it was sold was that the writing style was kind of Jane Austen meets Oscar Wilde. Now, I'm less of a Jane Austen fan, but I love an Oscar Wilde weird turn of phrase, and that is definitely the way this is written. It's purple prose, but it's good purple prose. It's the sort of stuff that's deliberate and intentional and only adds to the story rather than distracting from it.
Yeah, so we've kind of talked about what's going on. So you open up on a library scene where our intrepid heroine is in the library with a vampire. She doesn't know this vampire, and that is terrible manners on behalf of the vampire.
Absolutely.
We then find out that she's soulless, which happens within the first...
It's the first page.
So, pretty good pacing all about. I guess you meet most of the main characters within the first...
Two chapters
of the book. So we've got Alexia, or Miss Tarbotti. Tarabotti? Who, an Italian last name. Let's just... We're not good at pronunciations. Just know this about both of us now and cry later to yourselves, I guess.
Yeah.
Lord Macon.
Who is our Scottish lord, who is a little bit roguish, but, you know, a man of good standing.
And an excellently tied cravat.
And also a werewolf, which is just kind of a delightful combination, I think.
Yes, I think that comes to the key of what I like about these books, is that they, and I think we were talking about this previously, they make it so that the world exists wholly. There's nobody's like, oh, a werewolf, let me tell you all about werewolves, here's an info dump. It's, this is a werewolf, and he ties his cravat very nicely.
Yeah.
It respects your intelligence.
It's one of those books where it only gives you as much of the world as you need to know at that time. You never feel like you don't understand things, but you're sort of, you're not learning more than you need to, which is really nice because it gives you still a bit of mystery about all the finer details because they're not relevant right now. And it also doesn't overbloat anything with too much info dump, which I think is a problem sometimes with urban fantasy, which is what this is. It's an urban fantasy, but the urban environment is Victorian London instead of modern day.
So where do we go from here? Oh, she finds out that nobody knows what is going on with these roving vampires.
Yeah, so this first encounter with the vampire in the library sets her on a bit of a mystery because there is these random vampires appearing and they're not properly indoctrinated in the social etiquette. So,
which, as we all know, is a terrible, terrible thing.
So that sort of sets her on a bit of a mystery. And she also has a couple of strange encounters, a weird man with a waxy face following her. Yes. And it also brings her under the eye of the local vampire hive, which is another thing that's very unique to this, is the vampires are kind of structured like bees.
Yes, it's really nice, actually. We've got a matriarch at the top and then all of her drones who can't have babies. It's just the queen who can make the metamorphosis stick.
Yeah, it's quite neat to have, like, an explicit matriarchy with your vampires instead of, to quote what we do in the shadows, just biting one another's dicks around in a circle. Which is often an issue with vampire fiction, I think.
Yeah, just a little bit. And I quite like the setup, which is basically like, well, if you were going to have vampires and werewolves, you need some people to keep them under control. After all, this is Victorian England, not the colonies. Goodness gracious. BUR, which is the Bureau of Unnatural Registry, which keeps tabs on werewolves, vampires in society, and also ghosts and I assume other things, but they don't really come up in this first book.
Yeah. So they're kind of like the supernatural FBI, which is
pretty great.
Absolutely. It's a nice structure to go along with the supernatural murder mystery. It sort of gives some, like, existing form and, you know, makes it easier in terms of where the information comes from.
Yeah. I like the idea of police procedural that doesn't really have any police in it.
Yeah.
They kind of don't they show up once and that's it. Chapter one again. She stayed resolutely fainted despite a liberal application of smelling salts, which made her eyes water most tremendously, a cramp in the back of one knee, and the fact that her new ball gown was getting most awfully wrinkled. She's just talking about having found a vampire, seeing that other people are going to find the vampire, and then just fainting on command, which is a delightful way to go about things.
Yeah, I think the underestimating the frivolous and the feminine is a reoccurring theme in this book and also this series, and it's a really fun concept to see happen, the idea of, you know, it's kind of weaponizing the fact that you're underestimated, which is one of my favourite tropes within anything. Yes. Yeah.
Speaking of favourite tropes, the relationship between our intrepid heroine Alexis and Lord McCullen starts off as they're not enemies.
They're combative.
They are very combative, and I do like a man who likes a combative woman in a relationship. It's a good look. It's a good look for the book. It's not necessarily the best handled aspect of this book, but it at least makes sense.
The biggest thing about the core romance in this book is I feel like they function much better once they're established as a couple rather than the courtship, because the bickering and the sort of standoff, like the combativeness of their relationship works much better once they're established and you know they really love each other. In the beginning, it does kind of, it feels like the flip from them bickering to them snogging is very sudden. And I mean, it is in this book. There is an explanation for that.
Yes.
It's, you know, werewolf alpha nonsense, as I'm sure you would expect. But it doesn't, I think that transition is less smooth. And I think it's a timing thing. There's not enough space in that book to get from A to B super organically.
True.
Because it's a very fast-paced plot, there's a lot going on, there's a lot of things that are being introduced, and I think as the series progresses, because this is the first in a much longer series, it becomes much more organic as a relationship, and it works better.
Yeah, I do agree.
I see this coming a mile away.
But there's no second of, does she like him? Does he like her? It's all just, they kind of don't like each other. Oh, wait, no, they really, really do. Which, I mean, I guess can happen, but it's not.
Yeah, there's briefly, like, maybe a counter love interest introduced in the form of an American scientist. But that doesn't feel very sincere in this book. I think you don't really get, like, another alternative love interest until later books where, like, we have a French inventor lady introduced who flirts outrageously at all times.
Who doesn't love an outrageous flirt? Nobody. Everybody in this book loves an outrageous flirt. There is zero people in this book who do not love an outrageous flirt.
I mean, I get it.
Who doesn't? Lord McCon and her have a to-do about her being a outrageous female, I believe is the term that he uses. And she wants to get involved with the business of the Bureau. And he doesn't like that because not for really any particular reason. I think it's a...
Well, he can't because I don't think we've actually explained what the soullessness means in this series. Because she's soulless, she negates all supernatural activity. So she actually has to be registered under the Bureau. And I believe one of the reasons why she can't get involved is because they're actually not allowed to involve people who are, I think it's preternatural is the term that they use.
Yes.
So, like, there's bureaucracy preventing him from involving her officially. And yes. He doesn't want her involved unofficially because that's just dangerous for a lady.
A lady who carries a umbrella that is full of buckshot, tipped with silver, and two stakes in her hair, one silver and one wood. She's a lady who's prepared, is what we're saying.
And oh my god, this is just the first one. She gets an upgrade later. I guess we can keep going over the plot. So being soulless, she can negate
the abilities of any supernatural creature. So that includes werewolves.
They lose their fangs.
They lose their fangs and fur. And vampires who lose their fangs and immortality. It's a nice thing to kind of bring up because one of her friends, another main character whose name we are going to have trouble with, Lord Akadima.
Or Akadama.
Who's her vampire best friend who is gay. Very gay. So gay.
He is the most, like, for me, that's vampire goals. I really hope if I ever become a vampire, I will be living that life because...
He surrounds himself with foppish dandies.
In a beautiful, luxurious, baroque-looking apartment.
Yes. And is also much smarter than he lets on in this first book, which is quite delightful, actually. And that's something that I would like to talk about. I really appreciate how well-rounded every single character in this book is, possibly with the exception of her family.
I do think one of the sisters in a later book gets a bit more fleshed out because she goes on one of the adventures with
right,
her.
Yes.
But yeah, in this book, the family is sort of used as the I'm not like them and they are the them. So that's definitely shallow. But all your supporting cast are fully fleshed out. Like, they all feel like they have whole histories. They have pre-existing relationships with each other outside of our main protagonist, which is something you don't always get with these kind of books.
Yeah, urban fantasy in particular tends to suffer from a bit of main character syndrome, which is where all the action and every part of the story must centre around the main character. And honestly, it makes for a worse book in a lot of ways. So I do really appreciate that. Going back a little bit to the family, that's probably my main issue with the book is that she's centered around this very Jane Austen sense of Pride and Prejudice family. Her mum is a flippity gibbet, and so are her sisters, and her stepdad is a little bit milquetoast, would you say?
Yeah, something along that. It's very much these silly women are too preoccupied with marriage and dresses and all that sort of nonsense. And I'm not, you know, I'm interested in more important subjects, which is, yeah, it's definitely like that I'm not like the other girls nonsense, which pops up from time to time. But I think it's deliberately undermined a little bit by the pretense that we were talking about before about femininity
yeah.
and being underestimated, being weaponized, because even with her flamboyantly foppish best friend, well, friend, sorry, very good friend. They're very close.
Yes.
I think Ivy's the best friend. But
I mean, you can have
runner up.
You know, it's a level, not a title.
Absolutely. Lord Akadama. like, his reoccurring thing is that he uses the fact he comes across as flamboyant and a bit foppish, and the fact that all his drones are these, you know, underestimated dandies who are just, you know, you're used to seeing finely dressed men lounging about and being useless all the time, are constantly underestimated, and they're actually a spy network, effectively.
Which is great.
Magnificent.
So amazing.
You have a main character who's very much, I'm not frivolous and silly, but then you do have these supporting characters which kind of
play with that idea.
Narrative, which is, I think, why this book sort of feels less dry in that regard.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, speaking of the drones, gosh, I love Biff. Can we just talk about Biff for a second? He's delightful. He's the main drone, and I want him to have his own book.
He is definitely, you don't see much of him, but what you do, he is just absolutely delightful. I adore that whole sort of household.
Yes. To be honest, if I could go live back in a Victorian times with a vampire, that is a good household to be part of. Speaking of vampires, I guess we should talk about the Queen of the Nest as well. She's beautiful, unreasonably cruel, and exquisitely polite, which, as we all know, is the most important thing.
Absolutely.
You can be very cruel as long as you are polite about it.
You've got to do what you can as, like, one of the more powerful ladies in the country.
Indeed. So it seems like, at least in this first book, all the characters who are vampires are queer-coded, which is not unusual, I guess, but does butt against that sort of uncomfortable thing of, if they're queer-coded, like, as vampires, does that make queer people dangerous? Are we butting against that in this book, do you think? Or is it kind of just a fun coincidence?
I think at the end of the day, if your vampires are straight, you're doing vampires wrong. this is my own personal preference showing through, but at the end of the day, vampires are, like, queer right to their bone. And I think if you're, I mean, yes, there could stand to be more queer characters who were not vampires, but you, like, the vampires aren't all nefarious villains. Yeah, so even though, like, there's a bit of queer coding around our evil vampire, the Countess, there is also queer coding about, like, our relatively good vampire, and he's probably more explicitly queer than the Countess is.
Yeah, in fact, the first time that I read this, I didn't notice that the vampire queen or Countess was queer, and then the second time around, I'm like, oh, the actress is a lesbian. How did I not pick up on this the first time?
Exactly. And you've got other characters that feel like they could be queer-coded throughout the book, like Lyle. Professor Lyle is the second command of the werewolf pack. He feels like he could be one of those characters as well.
Yeah, for sure. I think he's a very well-dressed man who is interested in the clothing of other men.
He's your bookish werewolf, which I think is definitely kind of
a new thing. You don't normally have bookish werewolves. Professor Lyle is a great character.
Yeah, I love him. He's also one of my favourites for sure. So I guess we should get back to the plot a little bit. And shall we spoil it a little bit?
Spoilers.
This book has been around for a while. So your plot ends up sort of bringing you to, you've got automations, which are effectively golems, aren't they?
They tend to be golems. I think it's actually quite interesting because they're automations or automatons, as I do love that term, are golems, but they're science golems.
Yeah.
So,
they're kind of part golem mythology, part Frankenstein mythology.
Yeah, it's a fun mix. Flesh golem is a creepy thing to think about.
Less than ideal for sure.
Yeah. You meet a scientist who's played as a very gently secondary love interest for about 2 pages, and then we find out that he's too not Lord McCon enough.
He's mostly there to make him jealous, I think.
Yeah, which he does relatively on purpose. After he cuts her by not wanting to talk to her for a half a second, which as we all know, is terrible after you've kissed a girl to not talk to her afterwards.
He kissed her in public. It was quite a scandal.
Indecorous.
So we have him introduced, and he's kind of our entry point into the way that we end up with
the bad guys.
Scientists. Yeah, the bad guys.
Which is quite interesting, actually, because given that it's a steampunkish novel, it's interesting to have scientists as the bad guys, as usually they're kind of the main focus of a steampunk book. So it's a refreshing change.
For sure, yeah.
And they're obsessed with octopuses for some reason.
Oh, I can't imagine why. It's not like that's one of the symbols that you must put in every steampunk book.
Look, octopuses are cool, so I do get why octopuses are in steampunk, but in this case, I don't know. It seems a little bit... like they don't explain it in this book. I can't remember if they explain it in other books. Do they?
I think it... I haven't read all of the other books, but from memory, I think it just becomes a reoccurring symbol of when this organisation is around. It's kind of like the telltale, and I think they take a while to actually unravel what's going on there.
And this book, even though it is part of a series, is a book that you can read completely standalone. You won't want to, but you can. It finishes up quite nicely. The mystery is solved.
There's a happy ending.
There's
enough of a stinger that, you know, if you really like the characters, you can see that there's room for them to go places. Yes.
But you can read it and have a whole story, and that's nice.
That's, I think, all the best, like, series like this do that.
Yeah.
You have a complete story in your novel.
Because yes.
It's not fun if you have to read that much just to finish it.
Yeah, and I have to say, even if it's a bad book, I'm one of those people who, for the most part, has to know what is going on. I will forgive a lot of sins for a good story.
Yeah, so you end up dealing with your evil scientists, which evil mad scientists are so much fun. And the series resolves in, like, a really nice place because you end up with our heroine, like, getting some great things out of the terrible situation she was being in, including...
saving the man.
She absolutely. So her power to neutralize werewolves means that because all this action happens on the full moon, she's so important to our Lord...
Macon?
Macon?
That's what we're going with.
Yeah, we're going with that. Saving the day, because he can't function if he's not human. So she just has to hold on to his hand real tight.
Also, because he was a werewolf, he is naked.
Extremely naked. So much naked.
This comes up quite a lot in the last part of the book. It's mentioned a fair amount. And I do have to say, for a book that is... language-wise, I'd say probably PG-13. I don't think any of the language goes beyond that.
There's no curses in it.
Yeah, well, no modern-day cursing anyway, in terms of the sexual content. Like, it's very well written, and it straddles the line between purple prose and...
Not being too ridiculous,
which is a really hard line to straddle if you're channeling Oscar Wilde and Jane Austen's freakish love child.
Yeah, it's definitely fun. I actually think the purple prose almost makes it better. It's definitely got a bodice ripper sensibility when it comes to its sex scenes.
Yes.
But because the rest of the book is so flowery and in similar style, it just slots right in. It's not like she suddenly got flowery to disguise using the word penis.
Yeah, no. I don't think I think staff is the closest we get. It's great. That's what I'm saying. It's great. And it's made all the more fun by characters cock-blocking them or clam-jamming them at every turn.
It's just so absurdist, like, particularly at the end where, you know, there's all this nudity and there's been a bit of kissing because they had time to, so why not?
Yeah, there was a whole hour to spend.
Yeah. And then, you know, they've defeated the bad guys and they're on muck-up duty, but he's naked.
Yes. Being that he's surrounded by glampires.
All the dandy drones have come in to help out their lord. So It's just a whole scene of your male love interest getting objectified by other characters in a fun, flirtatious way.
And which is delightful because it doesn't cross the line into gross objectification, but it's like, oh, you're covering that up? That's sad.
And in fact, I think there's a line in there, something along the lines of various people doing things to, like, con him into having to bend over, and there's a comment that it's quite apparent that he knows they're doing this and he's just kind of gone along with it for the joke, which is kind of, it's also really nice to see a rough, like, male romance protagonist who's a bit brutish and, you know, a big werewolf.
Who's not a complete homophobe.
He's just humouring everyone. Yes. He's very good natured in that regard.
And I guess the thing is, and I guess this goes back to that whole vampires have to be queer. Like, if you've lived 200 years, which I think he's at least 200 years old at this point, you've got to have to experiment at some point, right?
It'd be very boring to be straight that whole time.
Right? I don't think anyone could be immortal and straight. Like, really. It just can't happen. We find out that there is, in fact, a council, I'd say.
They call it a shadow council.
Yeah, so it's some supernatural people who advise the queen. Roving vampire and a roving werewolf of some renown. In this case, they're the in charge of Her Majesty knowing about those worlds. And so this is where Alexia slots in neatly, in fact, as the Queen's personal preternatural council member.
Yeah, it's meant to be a three-person council, but preternaturals are so rare that there hasn't been one in that position for quite some time. So if there's an opportunity, she'll take it.
Yeah, and so I really like this book because it doesn't just end with her in a romance capacity. It ends with her in her life goal capacity of doing something interesting and important. And I think that's a really good end to a book, which is, like, basically a romance.
Absolutely, yeah. It's an urban fantasy with a really strong romance, like, plot to it.
Okay, I think that's kind of everything we need to talk about. Is there any last thoughts?
Final thoughts? I think this book is a lot of fun. It's a delightful kind of narrative. It's got some interesting things going on in terms of its world building, and I really recommend it. If this sounds like your jam, go for it, because it will be.
Yeah, I definitely think it's a really good intro into the steampunk genre, if it's not something you've read before, and it's a good fun. So yeah, if you enjoy Oscar Wilde, Jane Austen, and steampunk, this is for you. I heartily enjoy this series. I reread it, obviously, for the podcast, and was like, oh, I forgot how fun this is. It's just good fun. 10 out of 10 robotic contraptions.
Cogs and gears.
10 out of 10 cogs and gears. I'm Leah.
And I'm Bree.
Bye.
Bye.